This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
It's pledge season on Slate Podcasts. If you love working, you can help support it by joining Slate Plus at slate.com/workingplus. We'll be talking about it more later in the show.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
You're listening to Working, the podcast about what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. This season, we're sitting down with the writer and a bunch of artists behind the comic book Batman, or in this episode, a book called All-Star Batman, to learn a little bit about how their stories of the Dark Knight come together, from concept to execution. For this episode, we spoke with Dean White, a trained painter who has been coloring comic books for more than two decades, literally putting all of those hues and shades and textures that don't come from the pencils or the inks or the other parts of the art process. He talks about the tools of the trade, the computers he uses, about how he uses colors as well to control our sense of the passage of time, and discusses the pleasure of collaborating with other talented artists and creators. Then, in a Slate Plus Extra, White talks about how he's influenced by cinematography. If you're a member, enjoy bonus segments and interview transcripts from Working, plus other great podcast exclusives. Start your two-week free trial at slate.com/workingplus. What is your name and what do you do?
Hi, my name's Dean White, and I am a colorist or color artist for DC Comics.
What does that entail? What does it mean to be a colorist or color artist in the comic books industry?
Well, it's changed. Before, it used to be kind of a flat color laid underneath the line art just to help separate. In the last 10, 15 years, 20 years, it's really turned into a highly rendered painting aspect. So the important thing is that when I get a comic, I read the script and try to figure out where the emotional beats are along with the big action beats. And then I try to use color to enhance those moments. So it's almost, mm-hmm. I think of it like a soundtrack to a movie. So when we get to the exciting action, more action parts, I'll probably play a little bit more colorful. I'll do rendering and do a little more chaotic rendering to kind of make those moments seem kind of more exciting. And when we get to more emotional moments, I'll change the color and rendering to kind of set that. So it's all about trying to enhance the story. A lot of times the viewer, it's going to be subconscious, but you're trying to enhance it and make it read. So it's through color, lighting, and rendering. A lot of stuff that in coloring nowadays, you have a couple different schools. You have a light, almost flat coloring still going on, and then you have a more highly rendered school. And if you're a good colorist, you can do both, but usually I am hired for like the highly rendered, almost painterly comics.
We'll talk more about that in a second, but before we get to it, you're working, you said you work for DC Comics. You're working on a book called All-Star Batman, I think, right?
Yeah, well, I just finished up All-Star Batman. I did 1 through 5 of All-Star Batman, and then issue 8 of All-Star Batman. And then I just finished up a crossover that DC's doing. It's called Metal, and it's called The Drowned. And then I'm also doing a Nightwing miniseries right now.
Cool. So what is your background? Did you go to art school? Did you train for this work that you're doing today?
Yeah. Well, you know, from age 4, I knew I either wanted to be an artist or a scientist. And I didn't have the brains for the science, so I had the skill for the artist.
So same, except that I also didn't have the skill for being an artist.
So I went to art school, trained in illustration and fine arts. Actually, at 16, I got my first job storyboarding for local commercials and have done paintings, illustration for years, and then done even storyboards for live action and some animation stuff. So
Were you always interested in comics, or was it just something that you've found your way to through that other work?
Oh, you know, comics were fantastic for me. So when I was first going to first grade, they had the, back in the dinosaur age, they had the books Dick and Jane Ran Up the Hill. And the teacher said I was dumb, basically, because I wasn't reading these books. My dad said, well, you're just boring them. These things are boring. So he went out and bought me my first comics in first grade. And I got so in love with it that I just became a voracious reader. And then next thing I knew, I bought my first novel because I'd been learned how to read really well through comics, which was an Isaac Asimov novel. And next thing I knew, my reading level was like five grades above. So comics was my gateway into reading and helped me to, you know, find that love and interest in reading and expanding one's mind through reading.
What was your gateway to becoming a colorist for comics, though? How did that happen?
Well, you know, actually, it's funny because I was at San Diego Comic-Con. I actually got my first job at San Diego Comic-Con. And I was going around and I was showing painted pages. So originally, I was looking to do, you know, sequential artwork myself, fully painted. And I got two job offers. One was from an editor who used to be at DC, actually, who unfortunately passed away by the name of Lou Stasis, who was interested in me doing something called a Swamp Thing backup story, where I was going to fully paint it. And then another was for this new company Image that started. And they wanted to come in and see, because I could paint so well, see if I could learn the computer. And they had me come in, and I'd never touched a computer before then. And next thing I know, it's, you know, 20 some odd years later. It just kind of, you know, kind of fell into it and just started having a blast. Because at that time, you were using like Photoshop 3 beta. We were some of the first people to be doing, you know, coloring with Photoshop on the Mac and stuff like that. So just kind of got just sucked into it.
That's interesting. So it was really through comics that you started doing more digital work. You'd been doing working with physical materials more before that.
I was trained with oils, acrylics, watercolor, you know, charcoal, pencil, you know, ink, all that stuff. So I hadn't done anything on the computer until I walked in to Image, which was this subset of Image called Top Cow that used to be in Santa Monica on the 3rd Street Promenade. And I walked in there and sat down, and they just said, okay, these are the tools. And I just approached it like I was painting. And they came back like a half hour later and were impressed by everything. So I got hired and just, you know, went from there.
Did that background as a kind of highly trained painter, did that influence your early digital work? Does it maybe even influence your digital work today?
Oh, yeah. I'm old school this way. Like anyone who's going to get started in the arts, like I've taught for years too. And when I teach, I tell everyone, try to learn how to do everything by hand. Learn how to draw, paint, and sculpt by hand, because the computer is just a tool. But when you have to learn how to do something by hand, you have to really commit to something. You can't do the command Z to undo. Painting really influenced all the digital work. And I approach everything I do like I'm painting. And the knowledge of volume, you know, the roundness of something, mass, color, all that stuff.
So what's a typical day like for you? If we can just talk the particulars for a moment. Do you work this as like a 9-to-5 job?
No. I try to, but you know, it depends on the deadlines, you know. If I can, I like to be up about 9 or 10 at the computer working, and then try to wrap around 7 or 8. But a lot of times you have a lot of the pencil and ink pages coming in late, so you have to do so much so quickly that it's going to entitle you to be staying up even later. Like just this last week, I had to make sure I did a couple of all-nighters just to get stuff done because it had so many pages coming in.
If I can read between the lines there, it's at least partially because other people's pages are coming in late because other artists aren't always working 100% on schedule. Is that fair to say?
Well, no, I wouldn't say it's that. There's a lot of – it's tough when you work on monthly books because there's – you set up like the optimum way it should work, and then, you know, someone gets sick, there's power outage. One of the reasons I had to do it is we had a power outage here on Wednesday. Like, they're working on our thing and on our power grid, and I knew I had to get my work done. You know, I couldn't tell DC, you know, hey, sorry, my power's going to be out. So I had to stay up and do one of those all-nighters just for that. And then we had the artist had a real serious situation to deal with I would hold nothing against them. You know, anyone,
yeah, of course,
would have to deal with that. So it's just life, you know, life gets challenging. You get sick, you run a little bit slower, and you still have to work. And that's the thing about being freelance. I mean, it's great that you get to be freelance, or even if you're under contract with the company, it's great because we work out of our house. But at the same time, you know, we have to produce. And it doesn't matter if we have a cold, sick, or something else is going on, you still have to produce.
So you do work out of a home office?
Yeah. I work out of it's actually just my living room. I have a formal living room, and I have it set up so that I can be around for my kids, because we have two kids that were homeschooling, and so I'm able to be around for them.
That's great. That's awesome. So is it just like a desk setup? I mean, can you describe your actual workspace to us?
Well, we have a formal living room, and that's where I'm set up. And it's just, you know, my workspace is, I have a great desk that I highly recommend. It's called Geek Desk, and it's one of those electronic desks that go up and down. And that's, you know, like a 4 foot wide desk. And I have a Cintiq set up to my iMac.
Can you just, what's a Cintiq for listeners who aren't artists?
Cintiq is a screen that it looks like a regular computer screen, but you can actually draw on it. And how much pressure you apply to the screen, it's just like drawing on paper or painting. You can apply pressure and it makes more digital paint come out. It's fantastic. Costs about the same amount. I mean, they run between $2,000 to $3,000 just for a Cintiq screen. But, you know, for what we do, you can't live without it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have special tools for creating kind of paint-like effects on that, or do you just use a kind of standard?
It's just
stylus?
More that it allows you to put your it allows you to put the pen right where you're drawing and actually work on it. You know, nowadays we have things like, I have an iPad Pro with the Apple Pencil, and I'm starting to be able to do some of my work on that as well. So it's almost like that, but imagine it's 24 inches big instead of, you know, I have the 12-inch iPad Pro. Imagine it's 27 to 24 inches bigger. So
that's interesting, because that's actually similar to the size of the pages that you're working from before they get digitized, I think.
Right. Yeah. Usually the pages are 11 by 17.
Yeah.
11 inches by 17 inches, sorry. And then they get shrunk down to 10.5 by 6 or 7 inches.
Okay. And then do you blow that up when you're working on them on the tablet?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. That's actually the thing you have to be careful, because you can get so blown up that you get lost in the details. But the thing is, we're also going into the age of digital comics, where people are blowing up the screens. And looking at them, you know, digital comics, like for me, digital comics on the iPad is just amazing, because you got a fantastic screen, and especially with the 12-inch iPad Pro, I love looking at that stuff that big. It's fantastic.
So generally speaking, you say you tried to get started around 10, 9 or 10. How much of the day do you spend working? What are the rhythms of your mornings, your afternoons like?
You know, I generally work just, I'm usually going, you know, once I sit down, it's usually just going, take a quick lunch break, and then go back to work and go, unless, you know, my family needs me or I need to take care of something, but I'm usually working straight through.
Mm-hmm. And how long do you spend typically working on a given page? Is a page an all day thing, or is it less?
Oh yeah. Well, and this is the thing that you get to, you know, there's different styles in coloring. If you're doing more of a flat style, there's a lot of people that go through and will do 4 pages a day, no problem. And it'll look fine. But because usually what they're hiring me for is highly rendered, that takes a lot more time to not only put the color in, but then also you have to sit there and completely paint, model the form. So you're looking at like, where's the lighting coming from? You're setting up the lighting. And do you want to go naturalistic with this kind of lighting? Because it's a location shot and you're setting up the mood of the location, day, night scene. Or are you going for over dramatic because it's like this is a real dramatic moment and you want to change the lighting to accompany that? So that takes a lot more time to do the highly rendered stuff because it's just more time just going in there and figuring out how someone draws. Because that's one of the things I found is that, you know, I've worked with a lot of different great artists, and the key thing is to figure out how they draw and then to match my rendering to them. Because if I approach everyone the same way, it's not going to work because some people will build stuff up by boxes. Some are a little bit more sketchier. And so inevitably what I have, if I'm working with a new artist, is I'll actually pull up their page and then I'll pull up a piece of paper and I'll just like kind of sketch like what I'm looking at their artwork and start trying to figure out how they're building up the forms and then how to make sure that the rendering works with it. Cause I never want my stuff to jump out. I mean, you do, but you don't want it to look different. You want it to look like it's the whole art. When you get done and someone looks at the comic, it should be the page looks awesome. You shouldn't look at one part and go, oh, this person did great, but this person dropped the ball. So you have to make sure it all syncs together real well.
One of the issues that you colored recently, this All-Star Batman number 5 had, I think, one penciler, but something like four different inkers working on it,
right.
Each of whom have subtly different styles. Does something like that, the different ways that people are inking even one penciler's work, affect the choices you make throughout that issue?
Well, it's funny because I've John Romita Jr. was the penciler, and then we had Danny Mickey, who was the series regular inker, and then we had helping out was Richard Friend and Sandra Hope and Tom Palmer, and they all ink really differently. And that changes the pencil. So yeah, you have to adjust from there. Anytime. And I've worked with John Romita Jr. for, I think Black Panther was our first comic book years ago.
That's a terrific
And
book.
Every time you get a new penciler with him. So I know him really, I mean, a new inker with him. I have to slightly change it because it changes his art. And that's what John wants. John wants someone to come in and bring art to the piece. John's a fantastic collaborator to work with.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hi, it's your working host, Jacob Brogan, and it is pledge season here at Slate. We want you to help support this show and other Slate podcasts by joining Slate Plus, which you can do at slate.com/workingplus. Here to discuss it with me is Slate Plus editor Gabe Roth.
Hey, Jacob.
Hi, Gabe.
Thank you so much for having me on. I am here again to talk to your listeners about Slate Plus. If working is a podcast that you value and that you enjoy, then we're asking you to step up and support it by becoming a Slate Plus member. And in return, then we give you a whole bunch of extra stuff.
I'll say that Tom King, who we interviewed earlier in the series that you're listening to, the writer of Batman, is a Slate Plus member. And I hope that you will follow in his footsteps so that you too can become a Batman writer.
Be like Tom King. Be in a way like Batman.
What are some of the benefits that Tom King and or Batman receive from Slate Plus.
If they're podcast fans, which I know that both Tom King and Batman are podcast fans, they're getting their Slate podcasts in versions with no ads whatsoever, completely ad-free, including these pledge drive segments. They're not hearing me right now either. Yeah, Batman's not listening to me now. Yeah. And they're getting extended versions of their favorite shows, including this one. I know when you tape these interviews, then there's some material that's reserved only for the Slate Plus members that's not in the regular download version. They also get transcripts of this show. If you're a working fan, you will find that these meaty and deep interviews with folks from all different walks of life make great reading as well as great listening. Those are only for Slate Plus members as well. So extended ad-free versions of Working and other great Slate podcasts. There are also podcast miniseries that are exclusively for Slate Plus members. Our Slate Academy series on the history of American slavery, on fascism, on the United States of Debt. Those are all for Slate Plus members only. We've got more coming out for the rest of the year that I can't name right now, but that I am tremendously excited about.
And if you want to listen to those podcasts, you can or take advantage of any of the other benefits. You can sign up at slate.com/workingplus so that Working will get some of the credit, some of the acknowledgement for pulling you in, which would mean a lot to us. You can also get the Slate Plus newsletter, which comes out on Fridays and occasionally may include recipes that I've cooked recently. So if you're interested in what I am cooking and eating, you can subscribe to that newsletter by becoming a member of Slate Plus at slate.com/workingplus.
Join up. Sign up for Slate Plus, find out how to eat like Jacob Brogan, and so much more.
So much
more. All right, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Gabe. So let's talk about the way that goes generally. I mean, what form is a page in when it first comes to you? Do you just get an email that has a big old inked page in it, or what's the story there?
Well, a lot of times what I'll get is I'll get the script, and I usually don't have any say on the script. You know, I'll get the script, and then as the pencil is working on it, a lot of times they'll send JPEGs of the pencils that they're working on so I can see what the page is going to look like. Sometimes I've worked with people who just do pencils, and then I have to work off their pencils. And then other people, like with John Romita Jr. and All-Star Batman, he pencils, and then he has an inker come through. And so I'll see his pencils, and then the inker will finish the page, and then they'll send it to me from there. And so then I have a page, and it's black and white, and you're looking at something, let's say Batman in the middle of a field, and you're looking and going, is this day, nighttime shot? What do I need to do to make this really stand out? And also, is this a moment that should stand out? Because in comics, because we control time by how long you stay there, it's not like movies where movies is a lot more passive. You're sitting as an audience member, and the director's controlling the time. With comics, the viewer gets to look at the panel and decide how quickly they go through the panels and flip the page. So you're trying to decide, how much detail do I want to put into this panel? And the artist is deciding this, the inker's deciding this, and the color's also deciding this. And so you have to look at that panel. I got Batman in field. Is this a quick moment, so it's supposed to go by real quickly, so the person just reads it in 1 second? Or are we supposed to feel like this is a moment where he's contemplating, thinking something, so I need to then change everything, change the color, the rendering, everything to get that moment across and make the reader stay longer on there? And then you have to do that through the whole page and kind of figure out the balance of the page, because not only do you have that one panel, you also have 5 or 6 other panels that have to go along with it. And you can't have every panel can't have the same intensity to it. There has to be a kind of a rhythm to it that goes up and down. So the artist and inker have gone through there. They've thought about this. The writer's thought about this. And then usually the colorist is the final artistic process that the book goes through, where you can really change the artwork radically.
Yeah.
Because I've had scenes that have come to me that were drawn as daytime, and I had to make them nighttime scenes, and you know, all that kind of stuff, or the moods change, or I've had to redraw stuff. So it's taking that black and white page and then going, what is it? Is this day? Is this night? What color is it? And so on.
What program are you using to manipulate or work with them as you're first starting to make these choices?
You know, mostly it's been Adobe Photoshop for years. Mm-hmm. That has been, they kind of have a monopoly on the on the software on that side. So mm-hmm. mostly been using that lately. I've been using Procreate on the iPad to do some of my work on that, and that's been fantastic as well. Highly recommend Procreate on the iPad. Fantastic.
What about your interaction with the script as all of this is going on? You said you read through it, you get a sense of the emotional beats, of the rhythms of the story, where it's headed and such. But are you also constantly referring back to it as you work, or is it just once through and then you're doing your job?
You know, it depends on the script. Some scripts you really need to be paying attention to because there's a density to it. And other ones, it's more of like, you know, Batman lands in the field and he's running and he has to escape this person. And you know, at this moment, he's having a flashback and he's remembering. And you can kind of read those real quickly. Mm-hmm. So it depends on the script. But I need it there to understand what the writer's intent was. Mm-hmm. At least for me, that's really important because, you know, it starts with the writer coming up with the stuff and you want to make sure that the whole team's happy. So that's the other thing. When I finish a page, I send it to the whole team so they can then see it. And, you know, from writer, inker, penciler, editor, letterer, and I try to include everyone so they can all see it and make their comments.
Usually the letterer's work is not on the page at the time that you're working on it, right? Is that my understanding? Is that
well,
that sometimes happens simultaneously?
Yeah, you know, it seems like nowadays the letterer is actually doing a lot of his stuff on the black and white. So, like when the inker's finished, a lot of times they'll send that all off to the letterer, and he'll do his initial letter placement on the black and white, and then they composite everything once the colors are done. I don't always see the lettering, but that's why I try to include it to the letterer when I can, so they can see what colors I'm picking and stuff like that.
Fascinating. So, what kind of feedback do you get when you send those colored pages along? Are they ever like, are the other members of the team ever like, scrap it, start all over, or is it more of a back and forth that happens?
You know, everyone's had scrap it. I did a double page spread on this one book, and I thought it was great, and everyone else hated it. And it was, well, scrap it. And we talked through where the miscommunication went through and we understood where it was and I had to redo it. But I'd say that's a real, for me at least, that's really rare. Most of the time, I've been doing it for a while. They usually know what they want. So I think most of the time if I get any notes, it's like hair, eye color, you know, like just consistent stuff. Most of the time, I've been very, very lucky. I get to work with great people, and they tend to give me a lot of leeway and give me a lot of respect on what I do. So
I was wondering about that. I mean, how much freedom do you have when you're deciding how things should look?
Well, I within my field, I have complete freedom, pretty much. It's, you know, other than like, you know, you need to know if it's a nighttime scene. A daytime scene, you have to do that. Like you can't switch it just to have fun with it. You need to switch.
Of course, yeah.
You need to adhere to that. But, you know, no one's going in there telling me how to render. No one's going in there telling me how to, you know, what colors to pick. So I have complete freedom in that. And usually, like I said, I've been in the field for a while. So when they hire me, you know, they usually know what they want. We'll talk about like what kind of mood you want for the piece. So for All-Star Batman, it was kind of a high-octane, kind of Quentin Tarantino kind of feel to it. And so you want to get that through in the colors. So you don't want to go through and make everything somber because that's going to fight with the intent of the pieces. But yeah, freedom. I'm pretty lucky. I don't have much control over me in that way.
One thing I noticed when I was paging through an issue of All-Star Batman, issue number 5, was that there are sometimes these almost impressionistic details that sneak into your coloring. There'll be, you know, sort of swashes of little lines of aquamarine that trace across Batman's mask in one scene, or this incredible shading, subtle shift of colors across the clouds as our heroes are leaping off of a waterfall. How much do you spend thinking about those kind of really, I want to say eccentric, but that's not quite the right word, but those really particular details that you're introducing onto these pages?
Well, usually what I'll do is I'll usually set up like the page and I'll pick the whole panel, and I have a couple different Photoshop brushes I created that are kind of loose and sketchy brushes. And what I'll do is I'll go through and I'll pick the panel and I'll just paint quickly. See, I call it painting. I'll paint quickly on the panel, and I just kind of block out a big color for the whole panel. And I go through the whole page and I do that. So I'll block in the whole page with color and kind of building up my color, how I want color to move around the stuff. And then I start going into detail. And, you know, the hardest part is usually that initial block, not the hardest part, but the part where you're really thinking about is that initial part where you're laying in the big colors for the panel and how it works for the next panel and how it works for the next page. And then when you start fine tuning it, you're just kind of feeding off what you did before. And so it's kind of a process, you know. You think about it and go, yeah, I really want to have this vibrate here, or I want this to slow down a little bit more, and I want a sense of these clouds to have this kind of etching style. So I'll go through and I draw all these repetitive lines over and over again through them. And, you know, it's hard to say initially why I chose that. It was just more like I wanted this kind of feeling to it. And issue 5 is kind of the last issue, and we were under a really stressed deadline. So trying to get that out in time was just super challenging. So we didn't quite, you know, it was the end. So we kind of pulled back and we made it a little more action feel to it than the other issues.
Many of the characters that you're working with have these really iconic costumes, often in bold primary colors, probably partially as an effect of the way comics colors used to work. Do those longstanding age-old design choices place limitations on what you can do as a colorist today ever?
No, I call it challenges. But, you know, like if you got Two-Face and you're going to put him in a giant red costume, and you have Batman who's black and he has a yellow, and you have another color, another character who's green, usually what I'll do is I'll put those colors in, but you know, when I'm doing that initial scene where I'm painting in the whole panel, I have those reds affected by the scene around it. So if it's a blue atmosphere and I'm popping someone in there who has a red outfit, I'm going to tint all that red and paint a lot of blues into that red, same into the greens, and same into the black. So it's really affected by the color of the panel, of the kind of, you know, what kind of mood I'm trying to get across in that.
Interesting. So you're kind of bringing the world of the panel into the design of the characters in those moments, fusing them together a little
bit? Yeah. Well, because if you just do them just this, you know, like if I just did them like the straight color that they were chosen, and then I do this really realistic scene, sometimes they're going to really stand out in a way that doesn't fit in the environment. You know, it's not going to work. So, you know, you might have a scene that's red. Let's say we have a hot red scene, and all of a sudden you put Two-Face's red suit in there, he's going to blend into the background. So what are you going to do? Well, you want him to stand out. So maybe because he's in a red, yellow atmosphere, maybe that light's behind him, blowing him out. So maybe it's going to make him all darker. So you tone everything darker so he stands out against like a dark against light. And if he's in like in a blue environment, let's say he's around a bunch of waves and mist, if all of a sudden I had him just straight red, he's going to jump out and not look like he's part of the environment. So I'm going to have all these like blues and stuff going through his red, so he feels like he's really married and he's in that environment.
So it's really about bringing the whole world of the comic together, making sure that nothing stands out in the wrong ways.
And it's, you know, I have this weird process that when I get a page, usually the first thing I do is I kind of look at it. Imagine I'm a landscape painter, what would the natural light of this be? And I got this three process. It's kind of funny because I'll look at it and go, if I was there in real life, if I was out in this wheat field, Batman's out in this wheat field, or he's on the riverboat, going to jump off the end of this waterfall. If I was there, what would the lighting look like? And I kind of try to imagine what it looks like naturalistic. And then once I get to that phase, you know, I'll kind of get a feel for what the environment. Then I kind of take it and I move to a second stage and I think, okay, if I was actually a stage play, I need to change the lighting around so the light's just right on Batman here. And then I kind of go to that phase. And the final phase is I almost imagine it as an abstract, the whole page is an abstract, and go, okay, because we have to look, because we read the whole page as one subconsciously, how do I make sure that, you know, your eye moves from one panel to the next?
Do you think that the people that you collaborate with on these books are aware of how much you're thinking about these issues of composition? Do you talk with them about this at all?
You know, not really a lot. some are, some aren't. It really depends on how much they know of painting and drawing themselves. And some are highly knowledgeable and can notice, you know, immediately that, you know, like there's a close up of the eye, and because there's a moment that's being sold there, I highly render that eye and made real use jagged lines because he's saying something like, "I hate you. You've cursed my life." And so I'm, you know, we want that intensity. So, you know, instead of doing soft, like kind of S or C curves with the rendering, maybe I'm using jagged lines into the eye and around the eye to give sense of that motion. Some people catch that and some people don't, but they subconsciously, they always pick up on it.
Well, I mean, what sort of conversations, we talked a little about this, but what kind of conversations do you have with your collaborators, with the other people in the creative pipeline? Do you talk to them on the phone, or is it mostly just bouncing emails back and forth? What's that part of it like?
You know, and it depends on the people you work with. We have a cross section of new, younger creators coming in, and we have some real old time, you know, old school people. Some people just say, "Go do what you want to do. I love what you do. Go do it." And then others want to get on the phone and they want to go like, "I was really thinking through this process." And usually the best thing to do is to get on the phone. And anytime I'm starting with a new penciler, I try to get on the phone. And if I can't get on the phone, I'll email them and go, "You know, are you familiar with my work? Do you know what I do?" Because, you know, I'm, like I said, I usually people come to me for a highly rendered look, and some people might not want that. So you want to make sure right off the bat, do you want this look or do you want something not as highly rendered? And then it's, what is your intent? What do you, you know, tell me the kind of mood you want. That's usually what I tell my collaborators, like, what kind of mood do you want? And then let me build from there. And it's just, you know, you find what people are comfortable with.
How do you end up assigned to a particular book, like, say, All-Star Batman, in the first place? Is it the artist who requests you, the writer, or is it just that you get assigned by an editor after they find out that you're available or whatever?
All three. I've had all three happen. Usually it's about building relationships with the people you work with. On All-Star Batman, I would say without a doubt, it's John Romita Jr. brought me on that book, but
it's a venerable, revered penciler in the business, been around for a long time.
Yeah. And I've been lucky to work with him for a lot of years, and he's a saint to me. I mean, he just, you know, go do what you want to do, Dino. As he always calls me Dino. Go do what you want to do, Dino. Just go make it look good. But I've had other ones. I worked with Rick Remender for years, and he would pull me on projects. He's a writer, and he would pull me on projects because him and I had a great working relationship. And I've had great editors I've worked with that have pulled me onto books. So it's all about the relationship you create with. You know, people are like, you know, I like working with this person. He's going to deliver this kind of look. I'd say a lot of times artists get a – usually I have a long time working relationship with artists, and usually because I can only do so many books, usually it's no more than two or three books at the most a month. It's usually less than that if it's the highly rendered kind. And a lot of times once an artist gets with me, they, you know, we keep on working. Like John asks for me on every project. So that limits like how many things I can do outside of that.
Yeah. You have been in this business for a really long time. You've been working, you said, for like 22 years since 94-ish. Is that right?
22 years,
as a colorist. How has the business of coloring changed in that time?
Well, you know, I was lucky because, like I mentioned, when I came in, they were first starting to use Photoshop 3 beta to color. And before that, they were doing a lot of stuff with I forget the program, but it was this kind of mathematical vector program, and they'd have to color code everything. And Photoshop was the closest to painting. So for me, it was kind of perfect. So I came in right when they were moving something that was close to what I did naturally. And then it was just learning how to take Photoshop and do what you want to do. And I think it probably took me 8 years before I finally, I remember I just said, I was trying to copy what everyone else was done, which was using Friskets and lassos. When I first started, everyone was using this lasso tool in Photoshop, which allows you to kind of select area and cut it off. So it's almost like you take a piece of paper and cut a hole, and then where that hole is, you can spray paint in there, but it doesn't affect anything else. And that was kind of how comics were colored. And I think I was doing that for 8 years, and I was unhappy. And I just said, you know, I'm just going to color how I paint. And the minute that happened, and I could hear all these voices in my head saying, don't do that, because that's not how we do stuff in Photoshop, and that's not how we color comics. But the minute I changed over to that, that's actually when my career really started taking off, and I became more of my own person. But I'd say the biggest thing, you know, Photoshop's been there, and the tools have changed. I think some of the biggest stuff is, you know, I used to have FedEx people come to my door and have everything on drives and ship it to New York, because I live out in Southern California. Or I'd have to run to the LAX at 12 o'clock midnight to make the last plane and fly it out to New York so they get the printing. Is everything, you can send all the files through the internet now. And so you could be working up to the last minute and send stuff over the internet. Mm-hmm. I'd say that's probably been some of the biggest changes. And then I think in the last couple of years with the, you have like different tablets like the iPad Pro, you have different workstations that are now allowing you to be even more mobile. I think that's going to be the next big change, is how mobile we're going to start being able to be, that you don't have to be locked into a big computer at your home, that you can go to the park and work at the park, work on the airplane.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one, just thinking as a comic fan, thinking of someone who's been reading comics for as long, at least, as you've been making them, probably longer. One of the things that also seems like it's really changed in terms of the way comics are colored is the kind of paper that comics are printed on and the way that they're printed. I don't know how much of that has happened in the last 22 years, but you know, we talked earlier a little bit about the bold colors of characters' costumes being partially a product of the limitation of printing technology in the, you know, 1930s, 1940s, when superhero comics were first debuting. That's changed a lot. There are a lot more, you have access to more colors, to more printing technologies. But have there been any changes in the ways that comics actually get printed that affect what you do in the years that you've been in the business?
You know, I'm not knowledgeable enough on that. I was spoiled, because when I started at Image was really pushing the coloring at the time in the paper, and we were working at high quality paper at that time. Mm-hmm. And then by the time I went and started working at Marvel and then now DC, they're now pushing stuff. So I've been kind of lucky that way. I think there's less printers now than they're used to. So I think there's a whole challenge manufacturing that, you know, DC production probably deals with that I am not familiar with.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I guess those are separate issues in any case. But what's it like when a book is printed? Do you actually look at the finished product on the page? Do you page through it after a copy is done? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because, you know, the hard thing is that's the other thing, is every printer prints slightly different colors. So I want to see immediately that the book looks close to what I planned. And some printing places will print, you know, you can send two printing houses the same files and they can print slightly different. Mm-hmm. So I get the books, I immediately look at them as quick as I can. You know, I'll go out, you know, if I have to, I'll go out and buy the book the day it comes out just to check. DC is fantastic about this. They send stuff out to us the week before. Love DC for that. So I can immediately see if there's anything wrong, because, you know, as one book's coming out, I'm working on the second or third issue after that. And if something's too dark or the colors are shifting too much, that can ruin a book. And that's one of the things I've learned, is it's more in my end, for me, it's all about values. So for a long time, what I would do is I'd have on Photoshop, I'd have a layer, and I a black layer I'd put on top of all my other layers. And I'd turn on this, turn it to color so I could see the page as black and white and make sure that the book would read, if it lost all its colors and it was just black and white and values, that it would read that way. So for me, values are really important, so that if the color shifts from, let's say, a blue to a blue-red and it shifts everything else, it's still going to work value-wise. You're not going to lose stuff. You know, if I was working more impressionistic where it's about color shifts, not value shifts, you know, and you're separating someone by color shift, and all of a sudden these colors shift radically, you're not going to have the separation that was happening before. So, you know, I love working, like when I paint traditionally by myself, I love working impressionistic. But when I'm working in comics, I make sure that I'm watching the values, because, you know, color shifts can happen. And that's the other thing, like, I think is really important. Like, I'm at figure drawing every Saturday. I go to figure drawing, working with a live model, working on my figure drawing. I try to be out drawing and painting from nature. Like, go out and do like little landscape drawing and paintings, and try to keep my artistic well kind of filled. Because you never know, you know, when you, all of a sudden you're working on a page and you're having a flashback to something that you were drawing from life just the week before.
So when you look at a book, you notice that something's off, that the values, the levels aren't quite right, you might make changes that affect future issues of that title. Do you ever go back and rework an issue if, when it's printed, the colors don't come out right for future reprintings of it? Or once it's set, it's set?
Do it sometimes, you know, if they allow you to do that. I have done that. I don't get paid anything more for doing that. But sometimes I have been doing that. I think more and more that's happening. And there is a series that I want to go back and kind of adapt a little bit, especially with how I see how it works on digital comics. So you can do that, you know, because the monthlies come out. You know, each issue usually comes out once a month. Then after an arc is finished, so like for the All-Star Batman, 1 through 5 was one storyline. And when that's finished, we have a hardcover or a trade paperback come out. And so usually after you finish those 5 issues, you have a little time to go back and do any adjustments that you need to do and change some of that stuff. And I know All-Star Batman, there was some adjustment because issue 5 was so quick. We're doing the best we can. I was dealing with my mother, who was really sick at the time, going through cancer surgery. She's fine now. But we're juggling all that stuff during that last issue. So I think we went back and did a little bit more of adjustment when the hardcover came out.
I'll just say, you'd never know it from looking at the pages that you were rushing in anyway. It's a terrific looking book.
But thank you.
In this series of working, we've talked with some of the other folks in previous episodes about the relative lack of appreciation that, say, inkers and letterers get from fans in the comics business. Do you feel like that is true for colorists as well? Do you get respect, admiration, love, a following from readers?
I think colorists are getting more and more fandom because it's changed, and I think it's really evident how much colorists brings to the page now compared to how they used to be. So it's changing. I have people, to me this seems silly, but I have people that tell me all the time that they buy books just because I'm working on it. And I'm like, why? But so you do get people that follow you more and more. I also still think that there's a knowledge of how much work that there's done in what we do and what we add. You know, it's hard because, you know, it's almost like being part of a band, and the penciler and the writer are kind of like the lead singers, you know, and you're kind of backing vocals and instruments and all that stuff. So, you know, they get to shine a whole lot, and your job is to make them shine. But, you know, I think it's changing. I think it could be a lot better. But I don't go through feeling mad or anything. I feel lucky to have the job I have and have the career I have.
Is it a financially stable line of work? I mean, maybe that's a dumb question, but I assume, can someone make a living from coloring?
Oh, yeah. You can make a good living doing coloring. Yeah. Probably not the way I do it. I'm a little slow-witted this way. I tend to spend forever on pages. I try to make stuff. I'm kind of crazy with what I do. But, yeah, I support my family. I because we have kids with special issues, my wife and I stay at home and we take care of the kids. And, you can make a good living. You know, that's the thing. A lot of people don't realize in art, you know, they think art, you can't make that much money on. But if you're an artist, especially, you know, if you're in the entertainment field, you can make a good living. You know, there's so many things that call for someone to understand. And that's why also when I teach, I encourage people to learn how to draw, paint, sculpt, you know, learn all those things because you never know which way you're going to go. And I never thought I would be doing the job I'm doing. I just wanted to be the best artist I can. And I still pursue my own artistic career or growth on the side. I have to. That's what makes it viable. And I think that's the thing. The longevity in a career and to make a living is I think that you cannot just sit down and just go, this is how I'm going to work for the rest of my career. Tastes change. Art styles change. And you have to adapt with it. And I know, and since I've been coloring, I think I've changed how I color 3 or 4 times. Not by anyone telling me to, but just more me trying to grow and get better and have, you know, be the best artist I can on the page. And I think that's what gives you longevity in the field, is that it's someone who is constantly trying to grow in some way and trying to push. And you can make a really good living doing this work.
What's your favorite part about doing this for a job?
Working with the people. Honestly, that's the part I love the most. I think that's seeing, you know, if I'm just drawing for myself and painting for myself, I'm only influencing my own work. But I get to work with great people. And I get to see on All-Star Batman, John's an amazing penciler. And I get to see how he's acting. But then we had Danny Mickey on the inks. And Danny is just a god of inking. And what he did on John was just amazing. He because of what he brought to that book, inspired me to kind of change how I colored. Because I was so impressed. He was bringing this almost etching style. So I started bringing some of that into it. And we were all three of us feeding off each other. And then we had a great writer like Scott Snyder, who is just, you know, pumping us even more. So it's about finding that way.
Yeah. Well, we'd encourage people to spend even more time looking at your work. Thanks again for talking to us today.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Brogan. We'd love to hear your thoughts about Working. Our email address is working@slate.com. I'm a little behind, but I do try to respond to all of those emails. So if you want to talk to me, feel free to write. You can also listen to past episodes at slate.com/working. This episode wouldn't have been possible without production assistance from AC Valdez. Thanks also to Hannah Green, who helped record this episode. And a huge thanks to Clark Bull at DC Comics, who has worked tirelessly to connect us with the people that we've been interviewing throughout this series. Thank you so much, Clark. We really, really appreciate everything you've done. Finally, this episode and this series was produced and edited by Benjamin Frisch.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.